You deal a lot with, in part one, the tradition and memory, sorting out what is provable, what is really known, and what is myth. Give us your take on that.
Well, I mean, it's true that for a long time people read the sources trying to figure out how can we get facts out of them. And we have a fundamental problem, which is that the earliest Arabic sources we have, the Quran's one issue. You know, the holy book of Islam is a separate issue. But the narrative sources that we have tend to be almost entirely from the mid-8th century onwards. So underneath the Abbasid dynasty in the beginning, in the period when the central caliphate was in Iraq. The facts are very much selected on the basis of who was patronizing, you know, this writing. And so if we want to find out about something that happened in the 7th century, we're forced to look at much later sources. This is common. I mean, this is what historians deal with when they deal with South Asia. American history, you know, even modern history, you know, this is a common problem of later sources needing to be read for past. I mean, what I think you really can read these sources for, most productively as an historian, is to see how meaning was generated out of the past. The past couldn't be made up. I mean, I don't think we can think that this was fiction in that sense, but it had to be interpreted. So there were some things that you couldn't deny, even if you maybe as a ruler didn't like them. So you had to deal with them in some fashion. But you could adapt different details, you could take out elements you didn't like, you could make sort of abstractions of very specific situations that upset you. There were a lot of strategies that one could employ. But essentially, you know, one was dealing with a lot of unmovable elements in the past. So we can read our sources and find some facts, is the upshot of it. I mean, we can find the names often of elites of the period because those were undeniable. We can find the patterns of settlement. We can find elements of topography, meaningful settlements where mosques were built. But can we find, for example, really small detail about how institutions of learning were set up, for example, in this period? We don't have it. It wasn't part of the record.
Hugh Kennedy continues in his assessment of the book, stressing the importance of Salman al-Farsi as the first Persian to convert to Islam, and as a result, the very strong connection between Persians and the Prophet Muhammad.
Could you just expound a little on that in relation to the Prophet's companion, Salman the Persian, as he was popularly known?
Salman Farisi, as Salman the Persian, is a very important figure becomes a very important figure in the original Muslim tradition. His presence is not very well attested, but he becomes an important figure because he is a Persian, an Iranian, who was close to the Prophet, a great supporter of the Prophet. The Prophet talked about him, at least in hadith and tradition and so on. So he becomes a vital link between the Persians on the one hand and the Prophet Muhammad himself and his immediate circle on the other.
I think an interesting part of Sarah's book in the second half is about the development of the worldwide community of Islam, the sort of the trends of loyalty, the cultural trends. What is your take on how she describes that?
I think it's part of the cultural tradition, though it changes in different concepts, in different circumstances, in different backgrounds, of course. In countries where there are large Muslim minorities, for example, there's a different sort of consciousness and a different sort of loyalty than in countries where the Muslims are the vast majority. And even within Islam, there are so many different ways of looking at things, shall we say. And the Iranian Islam, at least amongst the majority Shi'i community, has very distinct ways of presenting itself. The use of pictures, for example, in spreading religious messages, the way you go into a mosque and it has pictures of Hussein on the walls and so on. It's a very distinctively Iranian take.
Sarah's obviously done a considerable amount of original source analysis, so it comes up with some different conclusions to that which are maybe widely held in academia. Is this going to be a controversial book amongst your academic colleagues?
Historians nowadays are looking at historical sources and trying to see what message that, rather than just reading the historical sources and trying to cherry pick little facts and do things like that, rather to read the sources in a more holistic way, if you like, And I think that Sarah's book will make a big impact in that way. And because she's an extremely good scholar, and because she writes very beautifully, I think that this book will gain a lot of followers. It will be widely respected and widely used as challenging but very stimulating introduction to this whole problem of the relationship between Persian culture or old Iranian culture or whatever you can describe it, and the coming of Islam, which is a dialectic which starts in the 7th century and is still very much with us today.
Sarah supplements Hugh's analysis on the importance of Salman al-Farsi in relation to Persian history by stressing the influence he had on Iranian respect for Islam.
Tell us a little bit about Salman the Persian and how an Iranian view of Islam developed.
Yeah, so I think Salman al-Farsi, Salman the Persian, is a really good example. So in the biographical works, in the works that deal with the Prophet's life, we have Salman, but he's treated very much as a non-Arab. He's sort of representative of a selection of non-Arabs in general. We also have this figure, Soheib, who is a Byzantine. So these are caricatures, in a way, of the world in which Muhammad lived. When we come to the 9th and the 10th and the 11th centuries in Iran, we have works written in which we have a whole different figure of this Salman. Salman, we know his family. We have legal documents pertaining to their rights. We have a lot of names, a lot of new names. So you see this, this issue of sort of Iran being written into an earlier sort of Arabic historiography. And it's probably based on local memory, in Iran. It's probably based on adaptations of what people orally transmitted. And some of it is, if we want to be a bit crass, some of it's fiction, and quite a lot of it's probably fact in some fashion. But it's all about meaning. What's saved is what's meaningful.
In talking about Islam as a worldwide community, it certainly appears historically anyway, that as a faith, it wasn't always imposed, as many faiths were in other parts of the world, by military force. There was a great deal of peaceful conversion. What is your take on that?
The dominant reason we have a lot of our narrative traditions is because people were making meaning out of the events that they witnessed, and their descendants were making meaning out of what their ancestors had witnessed. So this is local. This occurs locally. A lot of it occurred in Iraq, which is patronizing quite a lot of cultural production. So a lot of what we have is from Iraq. But we also have lots of evidence for example, in Gorgan, in eastern Iran, in Khorasan, in regions that are now in modern Afghanistan, in the southwest of Iran. We have all sorts of local evidence for communities adapting the tradition to their own needs. And this occurred obviously in many fields, not just in historiography. This occurred in law, this occurred in institutions, this occurred eventually, much later, with sectarian sort of developments. So there's a whole lot of ways that this happens. What's interesting, I think, about Iran is that you have the pattern, some of the selections of patterns being established for the very first time. And so if you look at the Iranian case, because we have so many sources, we have more Arabic sources for the early Islamic tradition from 750 to, let's say, roughly 1200 than we do for any other pre-modern culture, to my knowledge, maybe Tang China. Up to that day. So we have enormous amount of literary material, to sift through. And we can see all sorts of local sort of adaptations occurring. We also have sources that no longer survive, that survive in fragments. And that's fascinating because a lot of these can tell you about some of the contests that went on. And you can think about why this was cut up and passed on and why that wasn't within the tradition at large.
Sarah concludes the interview by discussing Iran as a whole in a historical perspective and how the conquest shaped the post-Islamic history of Iranian culture. She writes, "Many particular memories about the Sasanians and their empire, administrative practices, and family history had the conquest as an ending point, but they were also a starting point for Muslim Iranians, their heritage, families, and local history."
You deal in your book with the sort of changing of history. Who writes the history? The source of your sources. How accurate are they, or were they imposed?
I think if you're writing thoughtfully, you will always have some element of controversy in what you write, because real sort of academic work involves investing oneself in the field, in the debates in the field, and thinking if some of the questions can be answered differently. So I think probably, and others will tell me if I'm wrong, I think the issue that I've sort of highlighted that is perhaps the most controversial deals with Iran as a whole. You know, what is Iran? And my argument is that to refer to Iran in the period before, let's say, the 14th century, the 15th century, we can only use the term Iran meaningfully to refer to broader patterns of culture. We can refer to a geography, but we can't refer to an identity as such, not in the period I look at. The Sasanian period, there's an idea of Iran that's quite different. Under the Safavid dynasty, that's much, you know, much later, we have a different situation. But in the classical period that I look at, Iran is not the term used. And again, looking at the primary sources, if you look at any of the databases that exist and you put in the word Iran, what comes up in the classical sources is an idea that really is rooted in the pre-Islamic past. So the terms, or the geographers will define what other people might use the term Iran, but you don't have themselves referring to themselves as Iranians, which I think is important. The way that people refer to themselves, I think, says a lot about a culture. It says a lot about the way it's oriented. And in this period, you have different overlapping, competing, and complicated identities. You have a Persian ethnic identity, you have local identities, you have, you know, the beginnings of sectarian identities. You have people who define themselves by street. So there's a whole range of possibilities. And in modern discourse, the notion of Iran is too often used in a sort of polemical way. And this period is often referred to as sort of falling within the rubric of Iran, which I think it just doesn't belong. So that's one of my major arguments, I think.
I must say, Sarah, I found, you know, your scrutiny of the original sources absolutely fascinating. But what do you think your book will say to a modern audience? How will it be perceived now by Iranians, by Muslims who are looking at it through a modern prism?
You know, the question of the antiquity of nations has been a very important academic question over the last, let's say, 30 years. And it's been addressed for almost every major modern nation, France, England, Britain, Ireland, Scotland. This question of the antiquity of nations has been a dominant academic discussion. And also, it's reached far beyond academia because obviously it has major impact on the way that the world is negotiated and operates and functions in politics. The whole period of the post-Cold War period is very much dominated by nations asserting the right to have some sort of independence and autonomy. Iran has not been problematized in the same way, the antiquity of Iran as a country. In the modern scholarship, it has. There's been a lot of really excellent scholarship that takes apart the notion of modern Iran as a notion. But in my period, in the period that people often choose to go back to who want to deal with the question of asserting an eternal, everlasting Iranian identity, it hasn't been dealt with, bizarrely. I don't understand why. So I think one of my contributions is to take that notion and to try to argue that we need to think of sort of competing periodizations of identity that stretch across the Middle East.